Thank you for coming today. So Jeremy asked me, I don't know, a few months back if I would talk about the mental health system and sort of how to navigate it. And it came out of our church has been doing biblical counseling for, I was talking to Steve Mohorter last night. His very first class that he had was back in 1998. And because I asked him, I said, you know, I remember speaking at your class way back at the beginning, and I couldn't remember if I was pregnant with my son or if he was a newborn. So we figured out it was 1998 was the first class he had. So that was, what, 31 years ago? Long time ago. And so through the years, you know, I think our church has really progressed. I think we used to be, at the very beginning, much more on the side of if somebody's having a mental health issue, it must be sin. Got to be sin. And then through the years, and just, you know, further experience and, you know, trying to understand God's word and trying to put things in perspective, you know, our church experiences that at times people do have some significant mental health issues that are mental illness. And biblical counseling alone is not enough to help them with those, that oftentimes they might need medical help or assistance. And our mental health system is very complex. And so he's like, you know, I think people could benefit from getting some information on what to do and how to navigate the mental health system. So this first time I presented this to our pastors and staff a while back, but kind of expanded on it for today's purpose. So I hope it's helpful to you, and I welcome any comments or feedback in case, you know, other places asked me to do this as to how it might be more helpful to people in the future. But I wanted to start off by just saying, you know, I believe that probably all of you are in this room because you care about people. You care about your brothers and sisters in Christ and other people in your lives, and that you want to be compassionate. I think we're called to be compassionate. And we know as a result of sin that our bodies and brains are imperfect, and whether it be that someone is suffering because of these fallen bodies and brains or because of factors outside their control or because the Lord just caused it, allowed it in their life, compassion is really important. And compassion is not in lieu of also trying to identify where people brought suffering upon themselves due to their sinful personal choices. And obviously in those situations, we do need to adjust our language and our counsel and our help accordingly. Many extreme problems, and when I say extreme problems, I'm talking about some of the behaviors we'll be talking about today that are classified as mental illness. They could be spiritual problems, but they could also be biological problems as a result of mental illness. So while medical interventions, you know, have their place, I believe, in my experience and my profession, anything I talk about today is not intended to imply it's to the exclusion of focusing on spiritual factors, because medical interventions in and of themselves rarely cure everything fully. So we know God's word plays a big role in reversing bad thinking and feeling patterns when we substitute them with biblical ones. And so the need for medical intervention, all that being said, is not in and of itself anti-spiritual. Visiting a doctor doesn't mean that someone's failing to trust the Lord. And medical interventions, you know, including the use of psychiatric medications, they don't heal the ultimate problem of a person's disordered desires, beliefs, or choices, because medical intervention doesn't reverse sin in our heart. So it's only with the power of the gospel of Jesus that that brings about that full healing. And visiting a doctor, apart from considering how one is responding spiritually, isn't going to lead to ultimate, you know, solutions or assistance. So we want to be able to help people who are suffering from physical things, and we want to also help them examine God's word in the healing process at the same time. Our work is to love one another, both in the church and the world, in ways that everyone involved can see, trust, obey Jesus as our living hope, perfect love, and merciful Redeemer. So my talk today is to try to help us understand the medical mental health system and focus on when and how to access it. Because more than likely, sometime in the future, unless you've already been there, you will have someone in your life who needs access to it. It could be a stranger walking into the doors of your church and they're asking for help, and it's obvious they're just not right because they have a mental illness. And despite our attempts to help them, they're not able to process information or communicate clearly. They're upset or agitated to such a degree that we can't help them or reason with them or calm them down. Or maybe you have a church member who drastically changes from what everybody knows them to be, and you're asked to help, and what they're saying doesn't make sense. They're talking about things that you're finding hard to be real, or maybe they disappeared from regular attendance, and those that know them are worried because they're not leaving their home, they've lost weight, they're not able to care for themselves, they're just not themselves. Or there's our family members, friends, neighbors, who need mental health care because they're in crisis. So I'm hoping this information will be helpful to you in those circumstances, and that it will be a blessing to you. You know, as always, we always want to use God's word to test our thoughts, our beliefs, our actions, and to be praying for the people that God brings into our life for help, that we will provide care in such a way that does lead them to know the Lord or grow closer to the Lord and grow through the problems that they're having. So I started putting this presentation together a while back, and I like to ponder and work on things over time. And I recognized, you know, last week that, oh my gosh, I have way more slides than I can cover in an hour. Today, there's two handouts that were passed out. If you didn't get one, you can get one at the end. I made plenty of copies, and they're sort of supplementary things around communication, and there's one handout that is specifically beneficial to people who are in Contra Costa County, and that is our Contra Costa County resources that are available to people in the community. If you're not from Contra Costa County, you can probably find similar resources on a website for whatever county you live in. And it's everything from children's services to medical services to mental health services to low-cost care of various sorts. So anyway, I hope those resources are helpful to you. I'm not going to be going through them. They're just for you to look and ponder on your own. And I encourage you to, you know, do some reading on your own to learn about mental illnesses. And although there's some things certainly that, you know, I don't buy into, that I think they are just sins of the world, there are, I believe, legitimate mental illnesses in the world. I've been working in this field for over 35 years, and I've seen the impact that it has on people's lives, including family members. So I'm going to start off by just talking about what is mental illness. And this is kind of a medical definition of mental illness that I'm going to kind of review. So what's the difference between mental illness, mental disease, mental disorder? They're really all the same thing. They're just different terms about that. But they're disorders that affect one's mood, thinking, behavior, and they're generally associated with distress and or impaired functioning. And I know in the opening session last night, the DSM was talked about, and it was saying, you know, have we just relabeled sin? Because when you're sinning, you are going to have distress, right? Well, I think that there certainly are people who might call themselves depressed. And yeah, it is because of sin, but there's other people where the severity and degree of the symptoms they're experiencing related to their mental illness is may have started with sin, but it has led to a physical condition that's way beyond kind of the normal distress that people experience related to sin. So it can cause mild to severe disturbances and inability for someone to cope with life's ordinary demands and routines. And as mentioned in that DSM book last night, there's over 400 diagnoses, but 200 different forms of mental illness. And some of the more common ones are depression, bipolar disorder, dementia, schizophrenia, anxiety disorders. what's a mental health problem? Well, it's kind of a common term where someone may describe it or use it to describe someone who's struggling with their mental health. So maybe worry and sadness. But with mental health problems, majority of people who experience it can get over them. And that might be your counselee that's coming to you and they're struggling with anxiety or sadness. And we would use biblical counseling to help them improve. Secular people might go to a therapist, or they might try to go to a doctor and say, I need medication. But we know that God can heal, and that biblical counseling can help many, many people. How common is mental illness? It's estimated 9.6 million Americans have severe mental illness and need crisis care. And I'll define severe mental illness in a little bit. The most common mental illnesses are depression. So that is, I work in an acute psychiatric setting, and the majority of the patients that we have are there for depression, and they've lost hope, they're suicidal, they've either made a suicide attempt, thinking about suicide, preoccupied with death. Anxiety is very common, as is substance use, and many people have, when it says co-occurring, it means they have depression and substance use, or anxiety and substance use. So they have a couple different things going on. Depression and anxiety kind of overlap in many ways with some of the symptoms, and it can be confusing. What is it? Is it that they're anxious? Is it they're depressed? Sometimes they have symptoms from both things, and we know that anxiety disorders are very common, 18% of the population every year. I was just doing a presentation at my own setting for some people who don't work in our hospital, but within John Muir Health, and the emergency departments over the last 5 years have seen a significant increase of people presenting to the emergency department for the primary reason of depression or anxiety. And substance use is also there. So our emergency departments are definitely seeing the impact of people struggling with these conditions. It's estimated 1 in 6 will suffer from major depressive disorder at some point in their life, and 30% of these will be classified as severe. And one estimate stated that 50% of Americans are diagnosed with a mental illness at some point in their life. So what are the more severe mental illnesses that we're talking about? These are not as common, but they are ones that are that affect people in a more significant way. The three kind of most common severe mental illnesses are bipolar disorder, like manic depressive illness, schizophrenia, and schizoaffective disorder. And the reason they're considered severe is the impact on their functioning is so impaired. Where they aren't able to really, in their acute state, hold a job, take care of themselves. They look like they're not normal. We see many of these people. If you've been to San Francisco recently or you've been to Berkeley, the number of homeless people has significantly increased, and the estimates are about 65% of those homeless people have a severe mental illness. And so you'll see people walking around and they're talking to themselves or waving their arms and yelling, or, you know, like they're grabbing at things. And those are people who most likely have one of these types of mental illnesses that's untreated, and they are symptomatic and they just aren't able to really function very well. They're barely able to care for themselves. So what does medical science say causes mental illness? Well, they kind of have put it into four main categories: environmental, biological, genetic, and lifestyle. Environmental, the biggest factor is trauma. A lot of literature's coming out about trauma and its effects on children. And there could be more minor forms of trauma, if you want to say there's such a thing, and then more significant forms of trauma. In the medical literature now, there's a lot of writing about ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, and the effect that it has on kids and the negative mental health consequences. And for kids who have been abused, you know, they are seeing actually on imaging that their brains actually over time change to not look like normal brains. It actually has a physiological impact on them, which affects them their entire life in terms of their physical health state. And so it can disrupt their normal development and cause a lot of significant issues, including their developing brains. Also makes them more likely in the future to have mental illness, to use substances, to have learning problems, and be able to function as adult, being able to carry a job. They're three times more likely to have serious job problems in the future. Environmental factors, this would be homelessness or recent breakup from a significant other or a significant loss, and that tends to be a greater factor when it occurs before puberty. Genetics is another cause, and with genetics, they've done a lot of studies related to twins that were born and then put in different homes, and their parents were mentally ill, and they developed mental illness. And I have to say, we have a children's unit in our hospital, and the majority of kids we see that are demonstrating early signs of severe mental illness, 99% of them, their parent had schizophrenia, their parent had schizoaffective disorder, their parent had bipolar disorder, and even if they were taken away from the mom at birth and put into a home with a healthy family, they at an early age are beginning to show those symptoms of self. And that's what other medical studies are showing, that there's a higher risk. Doesn't mean they are for sure going to develop it, but they are more at risk. And then there's biological factors like medical illnesses. They believe that when people have strokes and heart attacks or cancer, the chemistry and the hormones and other things in our body can have an impact on the brain that can trigger and lead to depression. It's not just that they're depressed, they had a stroke or a heart attack, but they believe there's a physiological mechanism going on. And the role of those brain chemicals called neurotransmitters is also something that medical science is doing a lot of research on, because they know that there are chemicals in the brain, and they've looked at what happens when one chemical's too high or too low, what are the symptoms that can occur, and they truly believe that that is a cause of many mental illnesses, especially more significant ones like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And that's where they use medications that try to help regulate those brain chemicals. And then lifestyle. We have people who are using drugs, they're smoking pot, they're drinking alcohol. And when you're doing that all the time, it messes with your brain. And if you were in my last talk, I talked about the effects on the brain. But people with mental illness, it's sort of a chicken egg effect. Not only are they more susceptible to potentially develop a mental illness through their use, but if they develop the mental illness, they're more likely to use. There's a lot of co-occurring use with people with mental illness. And then another thing about lifestyle, it's, what we learned growing up, you got to take care of yourself. Any of us, if we were to go days without sleep, we could end up looking like a person with mental illness. Our bodies were not designed to go without rest and sleep. And if we abuse it long enough through not taking care of ourselves, that can have an impact and contribute to our feeling sad, our feeling depressed. And probably all of us have been there at one point in our life where we had a lot going on our plate, we weren't getting enough sleep, and you get more emotional. Right? And yes, we're supposed to respond in biblical ways when we're under stress, but sometimes you start crying for no reason, and it's because you're tired. Your body needs that rest. So let's skip this slide. So this is, if we were to look at that DSM book and, look at some of the common mental illnesses that are in that book, these are some of the signs and symptoms, and touched upon that with that other slide. But in that book, they talk about how many of these symptoms you have to have. You have to have at least 6 of these symptoms, has to last for at least 2 weeks, can't be as a result of another cause, and you have to have impairment in your functioning level to be classified. So it's not just that you have some of these symptoms, but you're significantly impaired. And then we have our anxiety symptoms, same thing. So you have to have a number of these. It has to go on for a period of time of at least 2 weeks, can't be due to something else. There's people who sometimes get panic attacks, and they don't fully understand the mechanism of panic attacks, but they're where somebody suddenly, many people describe it as they can't breathe and they feel like they're having a heart attack. Their chest is so heavy, and they end up going to the emergency room, get all sorts of tests done, and then they rule out everything's fine physically. And then it happens again. Or it may happen again. And so in those cases, they might say that person is, maybe having panic attacks that just seem to come upon them, and maybe there are no identifiable triggers. It might have been that the person was dealing with a lot recently, but nothing specific to when that panic attack starts. And then another more significant is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. And this is where people have obsessive thoughts that tell them to do things, and then they carry those compulsions out. And it can become distressing over time when they spend inordinate amounts of time carrying out those compulsions. So the person who is washing their hands for an hour and a half every morning before they go to work because their hands aren't clean enough, and they, you know, reasoning with them isn't effective in trying to help them understand they don't need to wash their hands for an hour and a half. So those thoughts are kind of out of their control. So those more serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia, it's where somebody loses touch with reality. So they're hearing voices or in their head that other people aren't hearing. They're seeing things that other people don't see. They may have thoughts that are delusional, that aren't real, but they believe they're real, and there's no rationalizing with them that they're not. They might say that they feel like their brain is playing tricks on them. They might think that other people are out to harm them or spying on them. And then bipolar disorder is kind of where you have unstable mood that goes in and out, and they really don't seem to have control over their thoughts and their actions. I also want to say that when people are in an acute state with symptoms of schizophrenia or symptoms of bipolar disorder, one of the signs is you really can't reason with them. You know, you may try to convince them, no, there's not cameras in this room that are watching you. I don't see any cameras, but they truly believe that they're there. Or there are no microphones in here that are recording your voice or people spying on you. The worker that's on the PG&E pole, he's not there to spy on you. He's there to fix the power line because it broke this morning. There's no rationalizing. Their mind is fixed that those things are real. They don't have good judgment, and their perceptions create fear and are persistent. And when you try to talk to them, it's very difficult. Children and adolescents, you know, parents might see that something doesn't seem right. Something's different about their child, or that they're different than others in their peer group in a new way, or they're starting to have difficulties at home or school or with friends, and they have much of the same symptoms as we've already talked about, changes in their personality, withdrawing, having difficulty with all those sorts of things. But children tend to also have more behavioral issues, and people might think they're just acting poorly, but really what might be going on is that they have something underlying that is related to depression or anxiety or a more serious issue that is going on. So all these symptoms that I've listed, one or more of them alone doesn't necessarily mean someone has a mental illness, but it might mean that they might be beneficial for them to see a medical professional for further evaluation, especially if the symptoms last longer than a couple of weeks or they're severe in nature, and or if they have several of those symptoms at one time that are causing them serious difficulty being able to function. And then major illnesses like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, even dementia, they rarely appear out of the blue, like where yesterday they were good, today they're not. Usually you'll see some changes over time, and people around them will feel like something's just not quite right in their thinking or their behavior or the feelings that they're expressing. Those are kind of the early signals before you might get to a full-blown state. And then I want to talk about temporary states. So there are some temporary conditions. One of them is called delirium. This is where people become disoriented, confused. They might even be hallucinating. You sometimes see this for any of us who've had parents in the hospital that are elderly, and maybe they undergo an illness or they have surgery. And coming out of surgery, they're like totally out of it. They're like not recognizing people. They might be picking at things in the air. They just are not able to carry a conversation. It can be due to other causes, infections, electrolyte imbalance, even medications, unfamiliar environment. So it's a temporary state and usually clears once the person either gets well from whatever they're being treated with for, or they get back into their home environment again. So I know my mom, who had Alzheimer's, she had a couple times she was in the hospital, and she got delirium every time. And sometimes it would be a couple days after she got home, sometimes up to a week, that she would get kind of back to her more normal self again. But it was very difficult, very challenging, because there was no rationalizing with her. She was convinced there was a police officer in the room with a motorcycle. And, you know, it's like, oh, okay, what's his name, Mom? You know, you just, there's no rationalizing. And in fact, she'd get agitated if you try to say there's not one here. So you just try to change the conversation, help them feel safe, not fearful. Also, those temporary states can be drug-induced, can lead to psychosis. Sometimes it could be someone started on a new medication. So I remember a young gal came in our hospital, and she went to the emergency department for a throat, bad throat, and they ended up giving her steroids, and she got psychotic. And she just had a side effect to that particular medication. And so we always want to have that medical evaluation to make sure it's not one of these temporary states that can be treated. So how do you discern whether it's biological or spiritual? What are some things to think about? You know, it's not always black and white. It's not always easy. I don't want you to think that this is not complex, but some tools I kind of generally try to look at or focus on is you look at their thinking process, because when it's a mental illness, oftentimes there's they lose the ability to think clearly and logically. So just trying to have a logical conversation, they are unable to do that. Now, somebody who you're counseling who is struggling with sin, they can still rationalize. You know, they may not see their own sin, but you can carry a conversation and it makes sense and they can track with you. Whereas someone with a mental illness, they lose that ability to do that. So that's one thing that I look at. The other is just the focus of feelings. So when people have significant mental illness, the person is overwhelmed with feelings to the point they can't function. They can't make decisions. They have poor judgment, and they have, difficulty reasoning. And so those are some clues, you know, getting more information, trying to understand if they're talking about symptoms that they're having, when did they start, what were the circumstances, how long has it been going on, how significant or severe is it, how are others impacted by the signs and symptoms, how much distress is it causing them, are they able to function, and is there any possibility for danger? Always have to think safety. When we have someone who is presenting with significant symptoms, should be on the forefront of our mind. So what are some basics of how to help? Well, I have much more detail in that handout I gave you, but five basic concepts. We want to talk with them and share our concerns. If we have a relationship with them, it might not be easy to do that at the very first visit if you don't know them, but if you do know them, if you've spent time with them, you want to be able to share your concerns, offer support, be a really good listener. And I know in the August session, somebody talked specifically about listening, but I put some other things in your handout as well. Practice reflective listening. Make sure that you understand what they're really saying by kind of repeating back to them or rephrasing to them what you think they're saying to make sure you're getting it. And then find your words to show support. And I gave some examples of kind of helpful ways to do that and things that aren't so helpful. So I hope that is a tool to you. You know, people are very nervous to talk about mental health or to share their symptoms because they're worried about judgment or being criticized. There's a lot of stigma in our society around mental illness. And, we know that they may be experiencing some pain as a result of sin, but regardless of whether it is of sin, we want to be compassionate and show support to help them through the process in a loving way. Okay, I'm going to skip some of these. So what are some early interventions? So if somebody comes to us, they're having some symptoms, but it's not really interfering with their overall functioning. But they're feeling distressed, they're spending a lot of time thinking about their symptoms, conditions, feelings. They may even be hiding their distress from others, but they recognize they're in distress and others are noticing that something doesn't seem quite right. In those cases, we want to kind of focus on their general well-being. Are they eating? Are they sleeping? Are they exercising? Are they taking care of themselves? And our biblical counseling efforts, you know, kind of at this phase early on can be very effective to help them through whatever is going on that is causing them distress. We want to make sure they're not isolating. That's one of the biggest things that people are tempted to do is to isolate. And it's one of the worst things they can do for getting the support that they need and also helping them through whatever they're dealing with. And so we want to make sure they don't isolate. And I think really Satan uses that. He uses isolation to, you know, continue to do battle on people who are struggling. And, you know, he wants to bring them down. He wants them to fall away from their faith. There may be times where it might be appropriate to seek professional support. And, you know, I want to just say, you know, if somebody's having symptoms that could be early signs of a more severe mental illness, it's not normal for people to hear voices in their head. It's not normal to see things that other people don't see or believe things that, you know, are not real. So in circumstances like that, even if they're still functioning pretty well, having them see a medical professional would be a good thing for them to be able to get evaluated to see if it's something medical that can be treated. Even something that is a med side effect or, you know, thyroid problem in their body, that sort of thing. Sometimes those symptoms progress and the person's functioning level is affected to some degree and they become more withdrawn from others. The people close to them notice something's definitely not right and their perception of themselves is not accurate in terms of their functioning, thinking, and performance. And I'll give you, you know, a real example of somebody, I'll call her Natalie, who she started off just by, she was kind of an anxious person, and she was kind of at a midlife place of life where she began to become more anxious and depressed about, you know, her home changing, her children had left home, and she was trying to find her place. She'd always been a stay-at-home mom, but she was isolative, and she began kind of ruminating on some thoughts that were not biblical, weren't healthy for her. But what it turned into over time is she believed her neighbors were watching her, spying on her. She thought there were secret cameras and microphones throughout her house. In fact, you know, when I went to go visit her, she came right out to my car. She wouldn't go in the house to talk to me because of the microphones that were there that she didn't want them hearing our conversation. Planes flying overhead were spying on her, and she had thoughts of impending death, thinking that her family members were going to die, and she was very worried, calling her husband at work 10 times a day because of that fear that he was going to die. That was affecting her sleep. She couldn't sleep, hadn't been sleeping for a long time, and reality testing, being able to say, I don't think that plane is spying on you. It's just flying overhead. Or let's go inside your house and looking around. I don't see microphones. I don't see cameras. Was not effective. But instead, the response was, I knew you wouldn't believe me. I shouldn't have even talked to you. I shouldn't have even told you. So what can you do with that, right? The person, that reality testing isn't working. And she was so fixed in her thinking, there wasn't that rationalizing. And therefore, it makes it difficult to try to use biblical counseling because she doesn't think anything's wrong, right? It's the people who are doing all these things to her. So in that case, you know, she did go get some mental health care. And she needed to get her sleep in order. So she, you know, got some medications that would help her sleep. And that made a big difference. And then she got some medications that could help her with her mood and her anxiety while she was able to then go into biblical counseling. And she was then able to see, wow, I didn't realize, you know, how sick I had gotten in my thinking. And so, you know, she was able to get back to her normal self over a period of time. And, you know, just an example of how that can be useful. It's really hard to watch someone struggle with mental health issues. And it's really hard when you're trying to help them with biblical counseling and they don't seem to be responding. And that can be a sign where they do need some professional help. You know, when we're dealing with psychiatric symptoms, not necessarily at the more severe level, but early on, you know, we are always trying to look at, is God trying to work in my life? You know, that's what the person should be asking. Is there something I should be paying attention to spiritually? Am I trying to avoid God or turn away from God for the work he's trying to do in my life? But when their symptoms outweigh the ability to do that because they're not thinking clearly, they're not able to organize their thoughts, they're not able to talk and process in a way that's going to be helpful to them, that would be a sign that they probably could benefit from some help. So then we have crisis. So what does crisis look like? Crisis is when there is a safety issue. So the person is what we would say a danger to themselves or a danger to others. They are thinking suicidal thoughts or maybe even made a suicide attempt. And we want to look at, you know, also how much of their problem is related to maybe substance misuse. We want to be worried if they're threatening to harm themselves or if they have a weapon or if they are experiencing those delusions, as I explained, or hallucinations, or they're overly suspicious or fearful of others. So all those things that are significantly affecting their safety and significantly affecting their functioning level to the point that you're worried they're going to lose control, that would be a crisis that we want to take immediate action for. And again, if they're not taking care of themselves, they're suicidal, they're having violent thoughts, that would be a time when we want to get immediate professional help. And the emergency department is kind of the place to start, but then you have to figure out, okay, can we safely get them there? You know, are they going to get in the car with us? Are they going to be safe driving there? You know, so maybe if they're willing to go, but you're not sure about their safety, making sure someone's in the car with you so that they don't try to jump out of the car on the way there. Or if it's that concerning, then you have to call 911. And that's where the police or the sheriff's department will come and evaluate them, take them to the local psychiatric service, PES, and they will do an evaluation and try to stabilize the crisis. Or if they feel that it is so significant, that they will try to get them help through you know, psychiatric services. So navigating the mental health system is very complex. It's confusing. It can be so frustrating, and it can be unhelpful at times. And when help is needed, it can really be alarming how difficult it can be to get the help that you need. So why is it so complicated? I'm going to kind of focus on four things. One is legal issues. In California, every adult has the right to make decisions about whether they want health care. So even if you have a mental illness, you can say no. So all those homeless people in San Francisco walking around that obviously have mental illness, they don't have to have treatment unless they meet one of those criteria, being a danger to self or a danger to others or gravely disabled. So they have the right to walk around and do all the things that they're doing as long as they're not hurting themselves or other people. So there is a process where people can be provided involuntary treatment, and that's referred to as a 5150. That's the welfare and institutions code that allows them to be hospitalized for up to 72 hours for evaluation and treatment. And that means they can't leave that psychiatric setting for up to 3 days unless the doctor discharges them and says, okay, you're good to go. And again, it has to be danger to self, where they're doing things to harm themselves, either intentionally or unintentionally, or a danger to others, or threatening or attacking other people, or unable to provide food, clothing, or shelter for themselves due to their mental disorder. And drug abuse doesn't qualify in that case as a mental disorder. So if I am a homeless person and I live under a freeway on-ramp, that could qualify as a home. So it doesn't mean that I qualify for that 5150. If I know where I can get food, even if it's out of a dumpster, or where I can go to a food shelter, and I have enough clothing that's appropriate for the weather, then none of those things qualify me as gravely disabled, even though I look very mentally ill. So that's what gets really frustrating for family members and significant others. It's like, well, it would seem that we should be able to do more to help these people. So after 72 hours, the person's either going to be released to leave, they'll be discharged home if they don't continue to meet that 5150 criteria. If they do, then they can be signed on for further treatment involuntarily. They can sign into the hospital voluntarily if the if there's enough symptoms present to keep them there. So that next hold is a what's called a 5250 or 14-day hold. And again, you have to have continuing criteria, danger to self, danger to others, gravely disabled, to qualify for that 14-day hold. So there's many people who decline receiving care, and it becomes very complicated. It's also complicated if they've committed a crime. Another barrier to accessing or navigating the mental health system is insurance. The type of insurance you have determines where you can seek care. So if you have private insurance, all the private insurance companies have contracts with hospitals where they will send people to get care, but they have very strict criteria that determine whether someone qualifies to receive that care. And the criteria are pretty much that 5150 criteria, danger to self, others, or gravely disabled. Kaiser, they have their own system and where they determine where people get care. Medicare could go to any hospital, but there's less options available for outpatient care, for follow-up care with Medicare patients. And then if you have Medicaid or Medi-Cal, you'll receive it through the county mental health system. They contract with other private providers, but they're very stingy about using those other private providers because it costs them more money than doing it within their own system. And then the uninsured is also through the county mental health system as well. And then the cost of care. Just to say, private insurance, although it allows more access and choices, the cost of care can be high. And also, a lot of times, private providers, they're full. And so, you know, they're on a panel that your insurance will cover, but they don't have any openings, or the openings are not immediately available. So another barrier to care, I've already touched upon it, anosognosia, and that is that people with severe mental illness lack insight. They don't think there's anything wrong with them. So the folks I talked about in San Francisco who are walking around and they're talking to themselves and they're doing all sorts of things, they don't recognize that they have mental illness. They don't recognize their symptoms. And it's more than just denial. They just they believe that because of some damage to specific parts of their brain, they're unable to really see themselves the way other people around them see them.
How did you spell anosognosia? It went away.
Oh, so sorry. Anosognosia. So they don't think there's anything wrong with them, and so that makes it hard. It makes it hard because they don't think they need help, and so that's where, you know, we have to try to build a relationship with the. I'm talking about our counselees, not going to the streets of San Francisco, but, you know, with our counselees who may show signs of significant symptoms and try to build a relationship and work with them around the benefits of how they might be helped with whatever symptoms they're experiencing. Because when people are delusional or they're hearing voices, they're scared, they're anxious. And so you could approach it from that end of, let me help you find somebody who can help you feel less anxious or less scared. There's people who can help you. And so it's good to have a partnership with professionals, you know, in your community so you know where you can refer them to. You can always start with their primary care provider. Primary care provider will know professionals that can take it from there if they feel that they can't manage it themselves. And so we want to give support to that person and to the family to know what the next steps might be in receiving care or treatment. And then access to care, I touched upon this, that insurance companies have an impressive list of clinicians, but when you call, you don't receive a call back, or the practice is full, or there's a wait list, or the next appointment is months away. Sometimes our county mental health system, actually, even though it's impacted, they have more services available to people, especially people with severe mental illness. So this is sort of the flow of how things work. You have someone coming in crisis. What are you going to do? Well, you want to get them to the emergency room. So you're going to either take them if it's safe to do so or call 911. And then they're going to go to some sort of psych emergency clinic, depending on what county you live in. Different places have different arrangements. They are going to try to stabilize them. And through talking therapy, sometimes through medications, or they're going to decide that they do need longer than crisis stabilization care, and then they're going to transfer them someplace else. And depending on what their insurance situation is, we'll determine where they get transferred to. If they have insurance, they can go to a private facility, like mine, John Muir, or other private facilities located throughout the Bay Area. If not, they will either keep them at the county mental health facility, admit them to their unit, or they will transfer them to one of the contracted facilities. Like, we're also contracted with the county hospital, so we get patients from there. Even though they don't have insurance, they are sent from the county, and the county pays us for caring for them. So their legal status is going to be continuing for up to that 72 hours. At the end of the 72 hours, they're going to decide either to keep them longer, let them sign in voluntarily, or discharge them. And so decisions will be made. But at the end of that time, they'll come up with a continuing plan of care. How are we going to continue to support this person in their mental health recovery? So they'll hook them up with outside either mental health professionals or programs that can continue to support them in their recovery at the end of that stay. So in psych emergency, they're evaluated by a physician and a clinician. They may run some basic tests to rule out that medical illness that might be mimicking a psychiatric condition, the crisis counseling, and then decide if they need to be transferred. When people are transferred to a psychiatric hospital, it's generally a short length of stay, 5 to 6 days on average, but some people might only be there the 72 hours, and some people with more severe symptoms might be there a few weeks. And the goal is really to stabilize that crisis, to develop a plan for continuing care with the patient and the family. They'll see a psychiatrist daily. They'll attend groups to learn about their illness and how to cope with it. They'll be closely monitored to make sure that they're safe. And then again, that discharge plan will be set up for after they leave the hospital. One of the frustrating things for family, significant others, laypersons who are involved in counseling with people is that we have laws in California that are confidentiality laws regarding mental health and even more strict for addiction treatment. And that means that nothing can be disclosed to any outside person unless the patient gives a signed consent. So even if that family is paying for care, they cannot get any information. In fact, the facility is not even supposed to acknowledge the person is in the building. That's how strict those confidentiality laws are. And it becomes very frustrating. I think some of the most frustrated families that we encounter are those who have family members who have severe mental illness. So they have schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or schizoaffective disorder that they may struggle with on and off throughout their whole life. And it generally starts in the late teens and the early 20s. So you have this young adult who they can't care for themselves. I mean, even if they didn't have mental illness, they have no job, they might be in school, but they're definitely not ready to go live life on their own. And the parents, who it's their insurance paying for the care and they live in their home, they can't get any information because the 19-year-old son says, "I don't want my parents to know anything. You can't talk to them." And the family's like, "What do you mean you can't talk to me? That's my son. He's only 19. Why should he be able to make that decision?" Well, because the law is set up that way. So it's very frustrating. And hospitals try to work with the 19-year-old son to help him understand, well, you're going to be going back to live in your parents' home. It would really be beneficial to you to include them in your care because you're living with them. and you need their support, and they want to know how to help you, and we can't work with them unless you give us consent. So the hospital will try to do that with the patient to help them realize, you know, that it's important to involve the family. So when are medications considered? Well, almost always, if someone needs hospitalization, then they will consider medications. When the symptoms are severe, when there's psychotic features, or there's a family history of mental illness, and others in the family have benefited from medications. If there's been previous episode or prior response to treatment with medication that have worked. Incomplete response to counseling alone. When the duration and impact of the symptoms on the person's life is significant. Also in substance abuse recovery. So the latest thing you may see signs around occasionally is for people who are addicted to opiates. There's medication-assisted treatment, which is a medication. There's different ones around, but Suboxone is one of the medications that can be prescribed to someone who has opiate addiction to help them get off the opiates and stay off the opiates. And it's used for a period of time to help them be successful in their recovery. So what about medications? Are they bad to use? Well, they're not going to cure the illness, but they will help treat some of the signs and symptoms that can help them get well. And it will help people with significant issues like with schizophrenia, psychosis, bipolar disorder. With depression and anxiety, some benefit, some don't. I mean, the studies show about a 35% effectiveness rate with antidepressants in people who are depressed. So from a Christian point of view, right, we know the heart, we know sin, that many times the issues are greater than just biology. It's because they have other things going on in their life as a result of sin that need to be dealt with, and medications can't fix that or address that. Most of the medications are not addictive. There's one class, the benzodiazepines, things like Valium, Ativan, Xanax. They do have a potential for addiction, but the other psychiatric medications, there's not a physical dependence. Medications aren't going to help us teach us to choose biblical thoughts or lead to peace and happiness or help us make better lifestyle choices, but they can slow down the thoughts so that they can think more clearly and help them be able to choose to make better choices, help them sleep, feel more energetic, help with anxiety so they can function better, and then benefit from biblical counseling as a result. And I like this quote from Lise Fitzpatrick in her book about medications. When deciding whether to take medications, we should take them prayerfully with faith, always looking to God as the true source of our improvement. He is glorified when we do this. Want to touch upon self-harm and suicide. I know there's a specific self-harm talk this morning, so I'm not really going to go into the same types of cutting behaviors that he touched on, but we do have to recognize that suicide is a real thing even in the church. We don't want to think just because someone's a Christian they wouldn't try to kill themselves, because when people get in such dark places sometimes, they lose hope and they begin to see that the only answer to that dark place is to end their life. They lose the hope of Jesus. And so we want to just be aware, and we want to be aware of symptoms that might suggest that someone is considering suicide. Statements that they make, whether it be about being hopeless or helpless, or they'd be better off dead, or they wish they wouldn't wake up in the morning. And people oftentimes are concerned about, well, I don't want to intervene and make things worse, so what do I do? Really, you can't make things worse by asking questions and showing your concern. And you can start by just noticing that their moods change, and they're looking sad, or they look like maybe they're stressed, and what's going on, and give them an opportunity to talk. I put in your packet, and I apologize that there's not a lot of time today to go through it, but you can go to the website, and you can watch a video on your own, and I put that on the handout. But the Columbia Suicide Scale is a tool that is used all over. It can be used by anyone, and it focuses on asking questions about two behaviors, thoughts of suicide and behaviors to act on those thoughts. It's a good tool because it's simple, takes just a few moments to ask those questions. You can get it online, so if you want to get your own copy. There's evidence that they've done research that it's a valid tool to identify people who might be at risk for suicide. It's effective. It's universally used. Over 100 countries are using it, and it's very efficient because of the time savings, and you don't have to be a clinician to ask these questions. And it's pretty straightforward. You ask someone, have you wished you were dead or wished you could go to sleep and not wake up? Yes or no? If they say yes, you ask the next question. Have you actually had thoughts about killing yourself? If they answer yes to that, you go to the next question. Have you had thoughts about how you might do this? Have you had any intention of acting on these thoughts? As opposed to you've had thoughts, but you definitely would not act on them. And then have you started to work out a plan, details about how you would kill yourself? And do you intend to carry out this plan? So as you can see, it's kind of color-coded. So, you know, if somebody were to answer yes to 4 or 5, 911, they need immediate help because they are high risk potentially for suicide and they need that crisis intervention, 4, 5, or 6, I should say. At 3, it's a concern. And I would say as a lay person, you would probably want to make sure that you get some support from maybe, you know, one of your pastors at your church to join you in talking to this person and getting some help. So we want to, whenever people are thinking about suicide, we want to be careful not to judge or shame, but we want to let them know that feelings are temporary. And we want to make sure that they understand they shouldn't be making decisions that are permanent, like taking their life, for a temporary feeling or condition. And so we want to make sure that we bring somebody in, whether it be your pastor or even a mental health professional, if they're hooked up with one, to be able to do a further assessment. And then again, 3 through 6, we definitely want to make sure they get immediate care. I put in some myths about suicide. They're in that handout that I gave you, along with the 800 numbers in Contra Costa County. For those of you who live here, if you dial 211 on your telephone, it'll take you to Contra Costa Crisis, or there's an 800 number, or text HOPE. And they're manned 24/7 to help people who are in suicide crises. We want to also be concerned if people, again, are psychotic or out of touch with reality in talking about suicide because they don't have the judgment. They tend to be impulsive, and we can't really trust what they say. Or people are volatile or extremely aggressive. Those will all be those 911 types of calls. And I want to close in just 1 minute. I know I'm over, but I have a little section here I added called Secret Sins. So you're working with somebody, a counselee, and something's just not working. And you're kind of trying to understand what is going on, what happens, you know, that this person doesn't seem to be responding. It's not really making sense. So things just in the back of your mind that you want to ask questions about, one is drug and alcohol use, because a lot of Christians don't like to talk about that. It's they know that it's sinful and they're worried about being judged, but that might be what's going on. And maybe they have a more significant problem than you're even aware of. And people can be addicted to alcohol and still be working at their job. We see that every day in our addiction treatment program. People of all socioeconomic statuses, all sorts of jobs, and they're going to work, but they're going to work drunk, but they're able to function. So put in, you know, some questions that can be asked around alcoholism. If you are interested in these, again, you can email me and I'd be happy to send you the PowerPoint. Another is there any kind of sexual, physical, or psychological abuse or trauma going on with this counselee, particularly in teenagers? And, you know, it happens in churches. We don't want to think about that, but it happens even in churches where you have families who look like they're really involved. And maybe you're seeing some things. And one of the things that I always think about is if I see a teenage girl, and this might not be the only reason, but if I see a teenage girl who suddenly started cutting on herself, or a boy, I kind of think, is there some sort of abuse going on? And that is their coping mechanism, not saying that's a good coping mechanism, but that's their strategy for dealing with it. There's a lot of shame and fear involved with talking about abuse to a church counselor. So we have to make it easy for them and ask those questions. And also eating disorders is another one where you might see symptoms related to, again, abuse or trauma. When you have a teenager who suddenly is developing an eating disorder, they're losing weight, they're not eating, or you hear they're binging and purging a lot, it could be because of that. And then just, I talked about that lack of self-care, that if we're not sleeping, we're not taking care of ourselves, we're not eating right, we're using lots of caffeine, then that can lead to some mental health issues. People with mental illness need relationships and connection. Our job is to instill hope, the hope in Jesus, and we can do that through relationship. We can do that through our caring and compassion. We want to be aware of making those referrals as indicated. We want to keep them focused on biblical truths to help them change their thinking and stop dwelling on unbiblical thoughts, while encouraging them to care for themselves. And we can use some self-monitoring tools, you know, in the process of that biblical counseling, making sure that they're putting into practice what they need to do to change whatever the thinking behaviors that are unbiblical are that are causing them to stumble. So thank you for your work and caring for people around you. And again, I hope this was helpful, and wish you well in your future ministry opportunities. Thank you.